This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Welcome to Season 6 of the West Wing Weekly. My name is Hrishikesh Hirway.
And my name is Joshua Malina.
Today we're talking about the season premiere of Season 6. It's called NSF Thermont.
Yeah, you know what I call this episode?
What?
Motherfucker. Talking NSFW Thermont. Yeah, that's what I did with my time off. I came up with that.
Okay. Tell us about the episode, Josh.
Okay, sure. It was written by John Wells. It was directed by Alex Graves. And it first aired on October 20th, 2004.
Let me read you a synopsis. In the aftermath of the Gaza Strip attack that seriously wounded Donna and killed Admiral Fitzwallace and two American congressmen, Bartlett faces strong opposition to his peace plans. Defying the wishes of the majority of Congress, including some of the White House's Democratic allies, the American people, and the Vice President, Bartlett persists in the hope that inviting Palestinian and Israeli leaders to participate in the peace talks will forestall the necessity of a U.S. military retaliation. Even Leo feels that the president should order an attack to make a decisive statement on terrorism. Bartlett's only hope is that a risky secret negotiation will deliver the leader responsible for the bombings into U.S. custody. Meanwhile, Josh hovers worriedly by Donna's bed in a German military hospital. As doctors try to stabilize Donna's deteriorating condition, no one knows whether or not she will suffer brain damage if she survives.
Nor have how we'll tell. Just kidding.
You can tell I didn't write that because it didn't say President Bartlett.
Hmm.
Well, Josh, we're back in season six, and this episode was shot on location in Maryland. Do you remember going out there to film this?
Strangely enough, I'll not disappoint you. I do remember this trip for a variety of reasons, many of which, sadly, I think I've already alluded to. So I have to see whether I have any fresh material. But one, I believe this is the trip during which I took John Spencer's ProVigil without knowing what it was, much to his delight.
Yep, when you walked in and there was a pill in his hand and you said, ooh, drugs, took it out of his hand, put it in your mouth and swallowed it without knowing what it was.
Never seen him laugh harder. And I've never stayed up later. Still, worth it. Also, this was our first time shooting out of town with Mary McCormick. And she was pregnant at the time. And it was cicada season in D.C. Mm-hmm. So I just remember her being on a bench at one point. And I knew, because she had been talking about it, that she thoroughly abhorred bugs and spiders and was not excited about cicada season. And so I just took a little twig and I came up behind her and I lightly touched her ear and she cried. And it was one of those things where, one, I didn't know her that well. So, you know, whereas I might have delighted in making somebody cry that I knew better, I felt really bad, especially because she was also pregnant.
Now that you do know her better, do you retroactively not feel so bad?
Yeah, that's a very good point. No, I feel totally fine about it now. I'm weaving in. I may even be retconning. I might have felt fine about it then too. I was trying to weave it in to make me look better.
Yep, sprinkling in some likability for that Josh Malina character.
Additionally, I will say, I know this story I have told before. The scene where we all get on Marine One is the infamous scene where we arrived to shoot and on the side of the helicopter it said Untied States of America.
Oh, that's this one.
Yeah. And there's a nice big shot of it looking the way it ought to in this episode.
One note, there are some who would say that the words appeared in this episode the way they 1900 do.
And I think I'm the one who said, hey, art department, that can't be right. I'm no expert. And I remember it being a significant problem, a big delay, and having to either print up or locate the correct decal and fix it. It was no small affair, and I think put us behind for the day. I think we shot for 9 days out of town, so it was a lot of fun. It's like going to camp with your friends, so it was great. I really loved shooting out of town. And I taught Dule Hill how to play poker during our downtime.
For money?
Yes. Well, I tried to explain to him that you can't, and I think this really is true, you can't really learn how to play poker so efficiently. Mean. No, unless you're risking something. In other words, when you play for fun, and sometimes people play online now for free, and it's, you know, you have a million units to play with or something. It just, if it doesn't cost anything, you haven't really put yourself to the test in terms of the types of decisions you need to make in a game that is played for money. So I played him, I think, head to head, and I beat him for about $350, which he could well afford. But I went to sleep. He was fine about it, and you know, he would turn ultimately into a decent poker player. But I went to sleep. This must not have been the night of the provisional because I went to sleep. And at 2 or 2:30 in the morning, I got a phone call in my hotel room. I pick it up and all I hear is, "Don't make me pay."
Oh, you have told that story.
Okay. So this is that story where Dule just kept saying over and over, "Don't make me pay." And it took me a while to even figure out what was going on because I had been in a deep sleep and I was like, "Oh, you're paying." We played for money. But he was so insistent. He never even really quite acknowledged the midnight, you know, the middle of the morning phone call. But I started to think, maybe I don't really know Dule that well, and he's going to kill me over this money.
It's not like the entire episode was shot on location. Really, the first three quarters of this episode is filmed on set. We're still in the White House for the majority of the episode. This episode and the next episode really kind of serve as a two-parter.
I think you could argue that the last episode served as a two-parter.
Well, the episode before this and the episode before that really also were two-parter.
So maybe we're looking at a four-parter separated by a couple months off.
Mm-hmm. You might even call this just like a continuing series.
And you know, in some ways, the show really is like that.
It is. Well, let's go to the beginning of this episode. Actually, even before the beginning of the episode, the previously on music here was noticeably more dramatic. It was not our usual previously on the West Wing theme that we've all come to know and love and be so familiar with that sometimes it sort of sinks into the background.
I don't think I even noticed. Can I just jump off of that for a quick second first and give you a huge hat tip for the mashup Parks and Rec West Wing Weekly theme that you created? It's getting lauded all over the internet, and I just want to add my kudos. That was very, very well done.
Oh, thank you very much. Kudos to Zach for talking me into actually doing it. It was something I had wanted to do, and then we got close to it, and I just was like, I'm not going to do it because nobody's really going to care. And then Zach was like, this would be a great thing to do, and I said, okay, fine, I'll do it.
Aren't you delighted? Do you feel the love? Wasn't it worth it?
It was worth it. I'm glad that he encouraged me to do it.
Huzzah. So what's different about the previously on?
Previously on the West Wing.
You're going on a Codel to the Middle East with Fitzwallace and Andy. No presidential hand-holding. You're going to see what's going on. Brief me and tell me about it.
It is not our normal tense, but somewhat sedate previously on music that happens, which is a mix of snare drums and pianos.
Previously on the West Wing.
You're going on a Codel to the Middle East with Fitzwallace and Andy. No presidential handholding. You're going to see what's going on.
And like I said, it's in some ways, it's become this kind of wallpaper for those moments as you get caught back up. But in this episode, and this happened, I think, in the season 5 premiere as well, it seems like Snuffy Walden wrote something new just for this, where the energy and the drama is kicked up. Like in the season 5 premiere, if you remember, the music was more hectic, and then suddenly it cuts out, and John Goodman says,
"You're relieved, Mr. President."
There's no moment where things cut out, you know, normally.
Right.
So this one, it already felt like, okay, season 6, things are different even still from season 5.
Yeah, the previously on footage itself made me feel like I was watching a different show. Mm. I mean, even though I've just watched the previous season, seeing it all together and the way it was cut together, it felt like...
more action-y?
Yeah, right.
Well, we start in and we see Navy officers with the casket for Admiral Fitzwallace. And our first scene is the president, the first lady, Leo and Kate in the car heading to the church. And I thought, this is a new dynamic. This is a new set of counselors. I mean, Kate, she's a new character, but there she is in the opening credits. So that's a big deal.
Yeah, of course. And she's got the president's ear.
Exactly.
Ever since she went home with him and lived with him for 6 months, they've become very close.
People are going to have to be reminded what you're talking about.
No, they're not.
That's a callback to a silly thing you said before.
Off of my idea that whole thing where she wouldn't, he's like, come with me, walk with me,
yeah.
Come in the car, here's my house, come in, live with me. Somebody sent me a funny YouTube video that is basically plays off of that. Oh, that's what it is. It's a Mike Birbiglia, Terry Gross video that is incredibly funny and sort of has that never-ending sense to it. It's a great iteration of the idea I was trying to get at. We'll link to it.
Oh, speaking of never-ending, is it...
Me?
Is this bit over?
Sorry. Are you referring to the Westman Weekly altogether or just that last bit I went through?
Just the last bit.
Okay, fair enough.
But so Kate clearly has found her way into the president's favor and Mary McCormack has found her way into the inner circle of the credits.
That's right.
And Abby's there too, which I thought I liked that. You know, this builds on what we'd already established in the previous season. Abby is now, you know, she's changed fundamentally her role within the administration, which is to say she actively has one. So as they're discussing international matters, she's going to weigh in.
That's right. I guess it's their way of keeping her off the street vaccinating junkies.
Can't have that, I guess.
No.
By the way, Kate says...
Invited himself to Camp David. What's he going to do next? Raid the icebox of the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I just wanted to give a shout out to the Council of Foreign Relations, from whose icebox I believe I have eaten. I've been there.
Really? Is it a good spread?
I was there for a wedding, so it probably wasn't their native foods, but it was very lovely. The cold open ends quite deftly. It sets up the president's attitude for the rest of the episode and everyone else that he goes up against. As I mentioned in the synopsis, it feels like he is fighting a lonely battle, ironically, for peace. But he says at the end of this section,
"And blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God."
Yes, I looked that up and it's Matthew 5:7. And which then made me, no, am I wrong?
I believe it's Matthew 5:9.
Well, he may look taller from where you are.
Actually, speaking of the chapter and verse of these lines,
sure.
I was surprised, though it made for good TV here, that the president took some liberties with the gospel, which I hear, you know, Christians don't like to do. That's why it's called the gospel.
Wait, what liberties?
Well, here's how Matthew 6-10 goes. We don't hear that first line, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled," which I think makes sense to leave that part out, as that seems to really be putting an argument on the side of people who want to start a war. So I leave that out, fine. Then in 7, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." And then 8 is skipped, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." We don't hear that line. 9 is, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God." And then 10 is, "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." So things get shuffled. They're put in different order. Things get skipped.
Number 17, you really won't believe.
I'm just saying it makes for a great ending to the cold open. But I could imagine some biblical scholars might note some.
Liberties were taken.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Might lodge some complaints. And then we go to our main titles, and the main titles look sharp. Mary McCormack, as noted.
Are they longer than they used to be?
I don't think so, because the song is still the same.
How do they do all that? The song remains the same. So who's losing time? I got to take out a stopwatch and see whether I got ripped off.
Yeah. That's a good question. I don't know.
Right?
Yeah. They're just adding more and more people in there.
Yeah. It'd be funny if it just, the music ended and then like the last three people just in silence. Hey, this sucks. Well, you joined late.
This episode is called NSF Thurmont. And I just wanted to point out that that is just another name for Camp David.
Right. It's the real name. I guess Camp David is the sobriquet.
And NSF stands for Naval Support Facility Thurmont.
Right.
It's commonly known as Camp David.
Okay, fair enough.
It's been around since FDR. It was Eisenhower who named it Camp David after his grandson, David Eisenhower.
Cool.
It used to be called Shangri-La.
Also cool.
Mm-hmm. Another thing about this episode is that that I wanted to mention up front. Now it's too late for me to do that, but I'll mention it now. John Wells won the Humanitas Prize for this episode. The Humanitas Prize honors film and television writers whose work inspires compassion, hope, and understanding in the human family.
That's fantastic. I was nominated for a Homunculus Prize for this episode. But I lost to Willie Garson.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm punchy here in season six.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's been a long podcast. It's been a lot of years.
After the titles, we come back and we're in the sit room. George W. Bush,
Do we have any evidence linking Iran to Nissan?
If we take this opportunity to strike Iranian terrorist camps, believe me, sir, we'll find a way to link the attacks on our people back to them later.
Are you suggesting we use the attack on our congressional delegation as a pretext to attack another country we don't know to be responsible?
Sir, I'm not suggesting that, but it's
clear
that we
all... What the hell are you suggesting, George?
There's ample intelligence to indicate
I'm not using Admiral Fitzwallace's death and the death of our congressman as a pretext to attack another country we don't happen to like.
I'm not going to send Colin Powell out to convince the American people that they're weapons of mass destruction. Yeah, very good point. I just wrote down, I should have thought of Bush. I just wrote down wag the dog. Like, that is a super wag the doggy pitch from the FBI director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just nakedly so.
Yes. Yeah.
Don't worry. We'll retcon it.
There are times when the ripping from headlines gets a little too on the nose for me. This is one where I was like, well, gee, tell me what you really think. Not, of course, that I disagree.
So you found it too on the nose, even as it didn't even occur to me as I watched it. But exactly. But you make a good point.
Yeah.
Now you've ruined it for me.
I had a question. How will these characters in the Situation Room come to a consensus on bombing Iran if they can't even come to a consensus on how to pronounce Iran?
I didn't notice that either.
Syria and Iran are the primary.
We start bombing Syria and Iran.
The only way.
Do we have any evidence linking Iran to Nissan?
If we take this opportunity to strike Iranian terrorist camps, believe me, sir.
Well, Iran at Camp David for one of the scenes in this episode.
That's true. You really did. Yeah. You ran really... 5 miles, according to what Will says.
That's a lie. I ran five takes of 50 yards each.
Well, I have questions about that scene, but we'll get to it. I love this scene between Colin Ayres and Josh in the hospital in Germany.
Where are you from?
Belfast.
Yeah, you guys are really the model on how to work things out over there.
Josh gives us a nice sarcastic snarky take on finding out Colin is from Northern Ireland, and Colin says,
yeah, we are, actually.
I know. Back in your face.
It's just great.
There's a subsequent scene where Colin's trying to get at the nature of the relationship between Josh and Donna.
Yeah.
Clearly, he senses that there is something romantic there that perhaps not consummated, but there's something between them. And he starts to tell a story about when he was younger, and the story gets interrupted and we never hear the end of it.
Right.
And I loved that.
Yeah.
I just like that.
Yeah.
It was started. I kind of piqued my curiosity, and it was such a real moment. And I like that we went on with that. There was never any payoff to that. There was never ever any return to that. It's just kind of good writing.
Yeah. We don't find out what the end of the story is, but we did get the most important sentence from him out of that story. You know, he says,
there was this girl when I was 17. She was mad about me, worshipped me, really. And I liked her, but I was off to university in Dublin, and she was going to stay in Belfast, working at that shop. She wrote to me every single day. And she called weekends, and she was always there. And I took her for granted, you know?
The most important sentence, I think, is, and I took her for granted, you know? I love that Colin, who's there as a paramour for Donna.
You think he's resigning at that point?
He's like, go for it, dude. Come on,
dude.
I should have never even been here, I think is what he's trying to say to Josh.
Yes. Well, maybe it's all over when the doctor comes out.
Yes, she could see you for a moment before we put her under.
Me?
No, Mr. Lyman.
Well, we do know it is all over. I mean, now we're jumping way ahead, but after Donna wakes up from her surgery, Josh lets her know that Colin has taken Donna's mom for some schnitzel, and we know now that Colin never returns from that schnitzel.
Ooh, that's some bad schnitzel you got a hold of.
I guess so. That's what I was thinking. Mandeville.
I made schnitzel last night.
Really?
Just to show how evergreen this show is.
It's always relevant.
Yeah.
I was thinking that there must be lots of schnitzel in Mandeville.
Somebody ought to write a scene that takes place in Mandeville.
Mm. Maybe we could get John Robin Bates to do it, and then we will never share it.
Well, in the great spirit of Mandeville.
Yeah, exactly. Josh somehow has missed the entire sense of not just nuance, but really just the basic facts of Northern Ireland and what has happened there when he makes that comment.
Yeah, it was a dense thing to have said.
But again, I like it because I think Colin just throws him off of his game and he's not at his best.
Well, he's much, much better looking than Josh.
But there are other moments in this episode from other characters where they really have no excuse for some of the garbage that they are spouting.
Like perhaps Will?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Will turns out to be a straight up racist.
Yes. I wasn't surprised by it because I do remember, I want to make sure I articulate it correctly, I don't object to saying anything as a character. You know.
Yeah. And even the things that you seem willing to say as a person are really astonishing.
That's true. But I do care what I say as a person more than what I say as a character. There's nothing wrong with playing a racist character. There are racists. But I do remember there are actually a couple doozies in this episode.
So now all Palestinians are terrorists?
The keffiyeh fits.
That's enough.
Oh my gosh.
Which is just, first of all, not clever and racist and a resounding yes. So there it is. Will thinks all Palestinians are terrorists.
Yeah.
Like, what is he doing there? How do they let him stay in the room?
Exactly.
How do they continue to interact with this guy?
Really, how does he even get to still have a position in the administration, this administration? I mean, in the current administration, he'd be right at home.
Writing his own ticket.
Yeah.
I remember at the time, I hated that line. I didn't object to saying it. I didn't say to anyone like, oh, I don't think Will should say this. It was just kind of like, oh, okay, that's who Will is, huh? People don't like me because I work for Bingo Bob. Give me a break.
I might have said his dad was Supreme Allied Commander of the NATO forces. And wouldn't you think that with that upbringing and that history and that connection to multilateral conflict, that he would have developed some sense of, I don't know, just, I would never think that he would write off an entire people as terrorists. I mean, it just seems intrinsically unwill.
I agree. I mean, now I watch as a fan and critic, and it doesn't really work for me. I mean, we've ramped up to it a little bit because there's some zealotry we've seen on his side, and there's some blindness in terms of his ability to see anything other than the 100% Israeli narrative. So I kind of see it, but I did bump on it watching it. I remember at the time filming, I'm like, all right, I guess I'm this guy.
Yeah.
But watching it as a viewer now, the level of disappointment and sort of difficulty reconciling what we've come to know as Will, and I also know what's coming after, and he kind of goes back to being, I think, the kind of guy you wouldn't imagine would ever say something like this. Hmm. And I'll even go an extra layer, which is, were he this closet racist, I don't think he'd say it out loud.
Right. He'd know how to read the room.
Even if you accept that that's really this guy.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, he's hidden it this long. And I think he'd have a level enough head not to say that in that room in those circumstances, even if he felt it.
Yeah.
So it's on a lot of levels, it's pretty disappointing. And also the earlier one where Will peeks his head into the room.
The president knows, right? You guys are telling him?
Knows what?
That there is no viable alternative. He's going to have to bomb Palestinians.
And it's not he's going to have to pick a military target.
He says there's no viable alternative.
Right. To bombing Palestinians, even just the way he chooses to phrase it, it sounds like he's just saying civilians.
Right. He's just like, some people.
It is what it is. And then a few scenes later, you realize, well, he considers them all terrorists.
Right.
So what he's really saying in the first scene is he's going to have to bomb some terrorists.
Yes.
Not a pretty picture of Will Bailey.
Yeah. That's, I think, the part that lets me down. I'm absolutely open to the idea that there are characters who are racists that might be on this show. It seems strange that they might have a position in the administration, but it feels really crazy to someone who has embraced the kind of complex and pluralistic viewpoint as the person who says to the president,
why is a Kunduz life worth less to me than an American life?
I don't know, sir, but it is.
Ooh, I didn't even think of that specific moment.
Yeah.
That's really hard to reconcile with this.
Yeah, he's speaking truth to power there, and he's talking about, it's just something that's within his grasp, and I don't understand where this comes from.
And the circumstance isn't, there isn't something else going on where you go, you know, I'm sure he would apologize later. He was going through something. They're sort of just discussing what to do and how to proceed. And yes, it's a crisis, but it's not like Josh's moment.
Exactly.
Where his dear friend and maybe the love of his life is in mortal danger.
Yes.
And so maybe we cut him some slack or we sort of understand why he's speaking the way he is with the extremity and lack of compassion.
Yeah.
Will's just there, one of the guys shooting the shit about how they should proceed.
Yeah, this is his policy advice.
Right.
Yeah.
Not good.
A more minor example of this comes from Toby Rest on Our Laurels Ziegler when he goes in and asks Leo, he says,
problems.
What's the president doing, Leo? A summit? He's already got a Nobel Prize. What's he need a second one for? Bookends?
I mean, he's already been president one term. What's he need a second term for? Like, what?
Yes, it's Toby Ziegler arguing against second things.
Yeah. Why would you ever think that the fact that he's like, what is he trying to do, man? Is he trying to solve peace? He's trying to create peace in the Middle East? Like, come on. He just is like, maybe we should aim lower.
Hmm.
I didn't know where that came from. You know, from a person who's always been at the president's heels trying to have him engage with his better angels. This also seems like some bullshit.
I believed it from Toby.
You did?
I'm disappointed in Will.
I feel like Toby would be like, yeah, let's think about the legacy. This is going to be an enormous thing. And yes, maybe it won't happen, but why not try?
Well, I mean, that's what I took it as. I took it as Toby's keeping his eye on where things are and where they're going to go politically, given that he has zero belief that any progress can be made in terms of peace talks.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, not at his best, but I sort of buy it more than I bought the Will moment.
Yeah. There's a moment when the speaker and the president meet, and the speaker, you know, gives actually, I think, a pretty well articulated argument for the reasons why the president shouldn't pursue the peace talks.
Members of Congress were killed, Mr. President. Instead of seeking justice, you're typing up name tags and then inviting them to play dodgeball at Camp David.
Halfley accuses him of appeasement. In this scene, there's a funny thing that happened, I thought, which is the president walks in, Halfley gives him this dressing down, and the president says, I didn't come here to play games, and basically walks out of the meeting, or he walks off frame. And then there's a shot of all of the Republicans on the other side of the table from the side, and the president walks to a side door to exit the room, I guess. And then he says, I'm trying to find a way to make peace. And as one, all of them like swing their heads to look at him. And there's just a really funny, awkward moment where you're like, what were you looking at this whole time? Like you can only look at the president once he's spoken, and otherwise your eye line has to be trained on the place where he last was when he made a sound.
Maybe it's a comment on Republican legislators and they're having to do everything as one.
Maybe. On that note, let's take a quick break.
And now, back to the show. Here's a question. I literally didn't understand this line. Doesn't the president refer to them all as right-wing turkey basters?
He does not refer to them as right-wing turkey basters.
I didn't understand the turkey baster reference.
So, Halfley says,
many people believe you sent congressmen into harm's way.
These the same right-wing turkey basters who said I faked MS to get the sympathy vote in the last election.
You know, that he had sort of intentionally sent this Codel with some sense of recklessness, right? That they're going to get hurt. So I think the president is asking if those people, the people who were saying that he sent congressmen into harm's way, are those the right-wing turkey basters who said that he faked MS? Maybe by deleting one letter and altering it a little bit, it's the president's way of avoiding calling them turkey bastards.
Ah, that makes more sense.
I think my favorite moment from this episode is one between Dawn and Josh. What, you know, after the doctor says she wants to see Josh, he goes in, she's being prepped for surgery and she can't speak. She's got a tube in her mouth, so she can only write notes. And he's, you know, asking her how she is. And he says, she's making jokes. She says, nice hat. And Josh is trying to make light of it, but then she just writes on the pad. She writes the word scared, and it's just killer. And like that moment, we are in totally new territory between the two of them in terms of their relationship.
Vulnerability and intimacy.
Yeah. Josh was shot and had to go into surgery and all of that, but she didn't see him right before he went into surgery. It was afterwards. This is just a new scene.
Some very fine pre and post-op acting from Janelle Maloney.
Yeah, I thought so too. And I thought Brad was great in his struggle to try and keep his composure, but also letting his own fear mm-hmm. belie that a little bit. I thought it was a really nice scene.
I agree.
Another part that I really liked is the way that things have changed between Leo and Kate, which we talked about earlier when we were way back in season 5, mm-hmm. when we were talking about how Leo had said to Kate, you know, he tells her basically to back off. Well, he changes his tune in this episode, I think. You know, Kate tries to actually apologize. She tries to apologize to the president for giving him counsel that might have led to this mess. And the president says,
I get lots of counsel, Miss Hopper. What I choose to do with it is my responsibility.
And then she tries to apologize sort of to Leo too, and Leo kind of echoes the president, but I think it takes on a different meaning. He says to her,
the president heard what he wanted to hear and went where he wanted to go. He's over 21. Don't flatter yourself, Commander. You're not changing the course of history.
Mean.
I actually think that Leo is talking more about himself here than he is about Kate. And I think it's a nice step indicating where this storyline is going. Because when Leo is talking to Kate originally in the sit room and saying, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah, you're out of line.
Yeah, it's coming from Leo in the mode of opinion that the president is impressionable and he can be swayed by Kate's advice. And I actually think that there's a little bit of optimism in that, as dark as it is for him to be like, back off, because it means that Leo believes that the president listens to his advisors.
Yeah, he's trying to protect his process.
Yeah. And Leo doesn't want an advisor who's going to be in the room disagreeing with him. But I think this is actually darker. Leo is more resigned to the idea that the president actually makes up his own mind. It wasn't Kate's fault that the president went this way. He's letting her off the hook. But by extension, that means it isn't Leo's fault if he can't talk the president into what he thinks is the correct course of action. Like, I think Leo is letting himself off the hook.
Right. That said, I think this moment is before their quaking, snarling interchange in the Oval. Right.
No, but I think this is evidence that this is simmering for Leo. He's blaming the president, you know, really single-handedly. It's not like he's saying, hey, look, we all gave him the best advice. You influenced him this way. I influenced him this way. Because if he were to really believe that, he would be acknowledging the idea that he gave the president what he thought was really great advice, and the president went with someone else's advice over his. You know what I mean? And instead, it's easier for him to say, well, the president just is going to do what he's going to do, and you can't take any blame for it. Also, you can't take any credit for it. And by transitive property, neither can Leo.
I guess, but he still gives it a shot.
Oh, yeah.
After this moment.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that's also, I love this, you know, it's such a cliche to refer to performance as brave, but John is so ugly in that scene.
When they
just go at it,
yeah,
you know, mano a mano in the Oval, and he's really like snarling and almost spitting, and there's something I think actually brave about the performance. He just doesn't care how he's coming across or how the character is coming across or how he looks. It's just like it is all out there, and there's almost a shock on his face. That's why I don't know. Maybe I'm pushing back against your interpretation of what he said to Kate, because I think it seems to me a little bit of shock there that he can't just bring Bartlett around to his perspective on this at that moment.
Well, I think maybe he's feeling like this, like he's feeling hopeless. And that's when we get
desperate.
And I think that desperation is laced into this last exchange.
They're deliberately provoking us, Leo. They know that we have to retaliate. They've studied us. They want us to overreact.
This isn't overreacting. It's the appropriate balance.
Tell me how this ends, Leo. You want me to start something that may have serious repercussions on American foreign policy for decades, but you don't know how it ends.
We don't always know how it ends. The Lincoln will be in position in a few hours, and then you are going to have to give the go-ahead for the bombings.
And the first time I was watching that, I was like, wait, he's making it seem like that's just...
Oh, you're going to do what I'm telling you.
And then the president says...
Or what?
And really gave voice to something that I hadn't even quite... I was still processing it, and I was like, oh, yeah, he's calling Leo on this being a threat. And what is it that Leo's actually threatening? And I think it's, you know... There's all kinds of things that he's potentially threatening, but certainly one of them is that, you know, you and I will be over.
We're done.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that sense too. There's one sense is maybe just politically you're going to have to do it. Like you're not realizing that you're going to be in a situation where it's the only choice. But I also got the sense too that there's another layer there. Like, I'm done with you, Mr. Man.
Yeah.
I will walk away. And the president basically saying, no, okay.
Because of this scene, I had to go back to season one, episode 19, Let Bartlett Be Bartlett. I don't know if you remember this, but when we were covering that episode way back in the salad days of 2016, there was a quote from an article that I had read where Martin Sheen talked about this scene.
We've heard it all before, Leo. You drive me to the political safe ground. It's not true.
I know it's not true.
Good.
You drive me there.
What the hell did you say?
And you know it too.
Leo?
We're stuck in neutral because that's where you tell me to stay.
You're wrong.
No, I'm not, sir.
You want to do this now?
Sir?
You came to my house.
Mr. President?
You came to my house, Leo, and you said, Jed, let's run for president. And I said, why? And you said so that you can open your mouth and say what you think.
Sir?
Where'd that part go, Leo?
You tell me, Mr. President.
We discussed the scene and how Martin Sheen said that the way they had first started performing this scene, they'd kind of turned the temperature up.
Very quickly.
Yeah, he described it as they were overplaying the scene. And the director, Laura Innes, came in and said, take all of that away and just talk. And that's what they ended up using in the episode, you know, this much more subdued version of it where they never get to the point where they're screaming at each other. And so seeing that ugly take that you were talking about, Leo really losing his temper and screaming at the top of his lungs, I thought it was an indication of how far things have gotten between these two characters. You know, that in another time when this is, I think, as close to a sort of existential divide between the two of them since Let Bartlett Be Bartlett. But there, they resolved it and they never got to the spit flying rage.
Well, one of the interesting things, it's almost, I can't decide whether it's a strength or a weakness of the episode, is that the same beat is being played out over and over again already from the previous episode. We're having the same essential argument made in only slightly different iterations over and over again. And at a certain point, it's like watching, you know, two people beat their heads against the wall.
Yeah.
You know, in one sense, I think it feels a little repetitive during this episode, but it also sort of, we're used to somebody giving. We're used to somebody making that argument that's just somehow more salient and substantive and swaying the other person, and there's a little give. And these guys have just been going at it now for a long time.
Yeah. Maybe it is an apt dramatization of people talking about Israel-Palestine. You know, it does sometimes feel like people are just talking themselves in circles and it's intractable.
Right. And in a way, it's great that John avoided any kind of sense of there being an easy answer and sort of chose to dramatize things sort of as they are.
Yeah.
It's sort of very, very little progress being made and two sides reiterating again and again intractable positions.
Yeah. I mean, that being said, there is some movement that happens in this episode, and I really like it. I love how hard won it is and how kind of how minuscule and how painfully it has to be extracted, which is this game of diplomatic chess that Kate and the president are trying to play between Israel and Chairman Farad and, you know, the U.S. constituency. Farad has accepted the invitation to Camp David. He pulled a them on them, but they also have to feel like Americans don't want to be bullied into it. They still want him there. They just don't like the way that they've done it.
Yeah, and they don't want the political calculus to be an act of terror brought them to the table.
Right. And I think they want to show some goodwill among all of the players to everyone, to the world at large, and to the people who are going to be actually directly negotiating. So they figure out this way that they think that they can make this work, which is that they don't blame Farad. They really think, you know, they really are pinning this on Nissan. They want the PLO to be the ones who bring them Nissan. If they do that, that can be a gesture to the American people that, like, look, this is the guy who's actually responsible. And see this move, this is like a move of an ally. They're helping us bring this person to justice, which we said we would do. But Farad has to deal with his own internal constituency. And it says, like, he can't do that. Anyway, I love that then the solution finally that they come up with is that Farad is going to get him, but he's not going to take credit. And they're going to deliver him to the FBI. So the U.S. can say, hey, we got this guy. But then they can kind of privately tell Israel, yes, they actually did help us do this. So right. Israel will come to the summit with them. It's multi-layered.
It's complex. And it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It's a good plan.
And it doesn't come out of nowhere. It's a slow jam.
Indeed.
That they end up playing. And I really like it.
And I like the way it plays out over those phone calls. The phone calls are well done.
Yeah.
The leaders.
Okay, so then it's game on. The peace talks are going to happen. This part I found really weird. It feels like, as I said, NSF Thermont and the Burnham Wood are two halves of a two-part story, but the middle point is not actually in the middle of the two episodes. Like, then they go to Camp David, and it suddenly feels like a new episode is starting.
Feels like the beginning of the next episode.
Right?
I agree.
Yeah.
Completely. I thought the same thing as I watched.
It's so strange.
In fact, in my memory, I thought that was the Burnham Wood. I didn't think this is how this episode ended.
Yeah. I was wondering if maybe it was because there was so much material at Camp David that they just had to squeeze some of it into the end of this first episode.
Yeah, that seems possible.
The change of location is dramatic. I mean, that's just like, oh, now we're in a whole new, there's a whole new set piece and a whole new thing on location, which, yeah, you normally would get at the beginning of an episode, really at the beginning of a season. But I guess the point is that, like, we're going to end this episode with everyone there, all the players at Camp David.
Right.
But it did feel strange, especially with this thing of they're getting on the helicopter. And then we see the way we're introduced to Camp David is by Will running through the woods. And there's something about right. the direction of it and just really the scripting of that moment that feels like the beginning of an episode.
Yeah, I agree.
The part that I was kind of surprised about is that with all of the security, you know, the president's coming, and with all of the security there at Camp David, how was Will allowed to bring those guns?
yeah, somebody tweeted a picture to me today, and it did spur that. I remember that I wanted to feature my arms. I think I rolled up my sleeves during rehearsal, and Alex was like, don't do that.
Don't do that.
And very unlike me, I just did it anyway. And maybe he didn't realize, and maybe he had already done a take before he realized, and like at that point it's like, oh, fuck it, all right, fine.
Yeah. That's great.
I remember that. I remember ironically having to have fake sweat put under my arms, because the sweating had, now that I'm old, nothing in my body works, but sweating used to be the bane of my existence as an actor. I'm a very sweaty guy, and you don't want to be like the guy who's always like sweating under his arms. So to have somebody actually spraying it onto my arms was a delightful change.
Was it hot? Did you really need the artificial sweat?
It was hot, but they wanted, like, you've been, you know, running for 5 miles
right,
sweat.
Right. And how much running did you actually do?
You know, a few takes worth of not that much. Much to my delight. I'm no 5-miler.
How about that Carnegie Mellon shirt?
Yes.
Someone just said, put this on, and you said, okay.
Well, yeah, that's my entire approach to acting. Do this, do that, wear this, say this, be racist. Okay. When do I get paid? No, but it's like in Scandal, I am often wearing a Dartmouth t-shirt, Shonda Rhimes' alma mater. I can't remember who went to Carnegie Mellon. It was always fun to, anytime you'd work on the West Wing and not be in a suit. Mm. So I definitely enjoyed the running scenes.
Shorts, too. I mean, that was brave. Speaking of brave.
Yeah. Right. To look like that? To go in front of a camera?
I'm just kidding. That was, it was exciting. No, it's nice to see some skin on the West Wing. So Leo is not invited to Camp David.
No.
And there have been plenty of times when Leo's had to miss something monumental.
You would think maybe Will wouldn't have been on the list, too.
That's one thing where I'm like, sometimes with some of these scenes where I'm like, y'all know he works for the vice president.
And he hates Palestinians.
Like, what is he?
Maybe we ought to keep him out of the room.
How does he get to be there as one of the gang? I mean, well, all right. He gets to go to Camp David? All right. The vice president isn't there. But the vice president's guy is there?
Well, maybe he's off camera.
Maybe.
Maybe they're in a bunk together somewhere.
But yeah, so Leo is specifically asked not to come, which really, the consequences of Leo's unspoken threat really are already echoing.
Leo has a line.
He doesn't like chaos.
That put me in mind to once again recommend the Netflix show Fauda.
Yes.
I'm pronouncing it correctly, which is the Arabic word for chaos, and which is an Israeli-made TV series about these undercover I think it's the Mista Aravim is the name of the unit that Arabic-speaking Israelis that go undercover in the Palestinian territories and operate undercover. And it is a very, very good series. You can decide for yourself whether it's balanced or not. I mean, in the end, it is an Israeli-made TV show, but so I think you could fairly argue that it shows an Israeli perspective. But I think it certainly at least attempts to give a balanced view or some balance or some more than a single narrative, and you certainly get a sense of some of the less savory and brutal aspects of the occupation in the TV series. It's also just a good television series.
Yeah, I would not recommend that people watch it if they're looking for something relaxing to watch. It's
true.
So nerve-wracking.
Yes.
The whole time. It's an incredibly tense show.
It's very unifying, is what my parents would say.
Unifying?
Unifying. I went to ask my dad the story because I thought I was going to use it on another episode. Oh, here we go. Okay. So this is my dad. I asked my dad the origin of unifying. We were telling our friend Yuri Rosen about your role in The Line of Fire, old Clint Eastwood movie, and urging him to see the movie. He asked if it was suspenseful. When we said yes, he told us that he could not go to see it. He said that he cannot take any movie or TV show that is too suspenseful. It affects his pulse and whatnot. And since then, we've referred to that condition as being unified.
Oh, I have a similar thing with horror movies. I like a good action suspense movie, that's about as far as I can take it. Mm-hmm. That gets me right up to the red line. Horror movies are past the red line and I cannot watch them. The only way that I can ever watch a horror movie is if I first go online, read, and this is in complete contradistinction from how I approach every other viewing experience. I try to go in knowing nothing at all. I try not to watch any trailers, read any reviews. I want to go into a movie theater and have the first scene of the film be the first time I'm ever seeing these images, you know?
Yeah.
But with horror movies, it's the opposite. I Google It Follows, spoilers, synopsis, everything. Like, tell me everything.
Oh, that's a good movie.
That happens. Yeah. And I enjoyed it after I found out exactly what it was that I was going to watch. Then I could watch it with a level of relative calm so that I was only completely anxious instead of unbearably terrified.
Jumping out of your skin. Yeah, that's funny. Avi, my son, used to do that. We would watch something on Netflix and I would see him sort of take the cursor and put it down in that bar at the bottom and kind of look just so you can kind of... I was like, don't fast forward. He goes, no, I'm not going to fast forward. I'm just watching the movie. And yes. Basically, he's going frame yeah, to kind of see, you know, as each scene is resolved. Like, okay, now I can watch it. Yep. He just needed to know. Same thing. Mm-hmm.
There was a line in this that Nick brought to my attention where the president says...
Party clowns, pinatas, build a mosque out of jello if I thought...
Leave it to Nick to find something super esoteric, yes.
He said, concerning the mosque of jello, it's a matter of debate whether gelatin is permissible to eat by practicing Muslims. Because, you know, gelatin is made from horses, right?
I don't know. I know it's made from various animals. And of course, Nick is referring to the laws of halal.
Right.
And there's certainly, gelatin is a questionable substance in terms of kashrut and the laws of being kosher as well.
Right.
I know that the conservative movement some years back decided that gelatin, because there's something called K-gel and there's also vegan gelatin version.
Yeah.
To have
and there is
effect.
Halal gelatin available too.
I'm not surprised. And there's also kosher gelatin, which I think is maybe made from fish or something. But also the conservative movement decided that gelatin, maybe from anything, is so far removed ultimately when it becomes part of another food, so far removed from what it was that it was considered kosher. I just remember being very excited because this is when my family began eating Mentos.
Mentos have gelatin?
Well, they certainly did at the time.
Yeah, Mentos, not vegan. Who knew? I guess you knew.
Well, let me see if that's true. Are Mentos vegetarian? Unfortunately, Mentos 3-layer strawberry squeeze and juice burst gum are all unsuitable for vegetarians. Okay, so it's a raging, there's gelatin.
Yeah. Anyway, he was opening up a whole other non-halal can of worms.
Right.
By suggesting a mosque made of gelatin.
Right. By the way, anyone who's kosher or observes halal would not eat a can of worms.
On that note, I think it might be time to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The West Wing Weekly. Thanks for breaking through into season 6 with us.
You know, I meant to call you Yaakov in this episode.
You meant to call me?
I meant to have called you Yaakov this whole time, and I forgot to. If you're still looking for some last-minute holiday presents, check out thewestwingweekly.com/merch.
Or if you're shopping super early for next year, go to the same place.
That's right. Only 390 days until Christmas 2019.
That's right.
Thanks so much to Zach McNeese, Margaret Miller, and Nick Song.
All of whom you got to know a little bit better in last week's minisode. Thanks to PRX and Radiotopia for allowing us to be part of their fancy collection of the world's best podcasts. You can sample the others at radiotopia.fm.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.